All right, welcome to today's edition of Pipeline Things. Our guest, it's quite possible to say, began working in the industry before many of you who are listening were born. He is an esteemed member, contributed significant amounts to much of the, foundations yeah. that serve as guidance and even some of the regulations that fit in our industry today. As he comes on to talk about risk, PIR, where that came from, and really maybe what we should be doing as operators and even looking forward to the impacts and what does PIR look like for hydrogen and CO2. I think it's a great episode. Thank you for joining us on today's edition of Pipeline Things. All right. Hey, welcome to today's edition of Pipeline Things. I am your host, Brett Dotson, my co-host, Christopher DeLeon. As you can see, if you're on the video, you can tell that things look a little bit different. We're in headsets, and that's because we're actually going to be doing a virtual guest today. Yep. Really excited about that particular virtual guest and when he comes on. But before we do that, it's probably good just to catch up a little bit. You know, we started this second arc. This is the second episode
of the arcs.
Of the arc. Yep. And Christopher, what are we calling this arc?
Sage. The sages.
Not like the spice that you put in gumbo,
no,
right?
Not little green stuff.
Not little green stuff. Yeah, no, but sage in terms of wisdom.
Masters. Wisdom, teachers.
Yeah, because you thought that was preferable to calling it the OG arc?
Yeah, you know, because different people would have different interpretations of OG, and people might not identify with that, so we figured sage would be a little bit more...
Sage is more appropriate. That's what you wanted to go with.
Masters, teachers.
You know, this might actually be the first time for our audience that Chris cared what somebody else thought. It's really... Oh, Chris, I miss you.
So you know I'm a semi-private person. You keep revealing things about me on this show. You need to stop.
It's like I force it out. Like, if people want to know who... If you want to know the real Christopher, you have to listen to Pipeline Things in order to get the real thing.
You continue to reveal stuff that people shouldn't know.
Yeah. So it's really great. I'm actually excited about this this particular guest. So this guest, I guess he's a fan of the show. I don't know, but we bought him on because he offered us feedback. But many people may not know that this is actually his second appearance. Yeah, that's true. We should offer like some type of a reward.
Yeah.
You know what? If you can, I tell you what, if you're listening to the show and you can email me or email Miss Producer or email information at D2 Integrity with where this particular guest appeared
first
prior,
appeared.
First appeared. We will send you
something.
Don't
overcommit.
No, the one of the D2i branded Yeti cups.
Oh, you know who does that, right?
Yeah. No, I do. But no, this is one of the nice ones. And I'm not saying theirs are nice, but that's the only thing I have in hand, right?
You know, our podcast does have video, and the other person's podcast does not have video. Man. So they may give Yetis, but we give nice Yetis, apparently. You're going to get a text when this airs.
We're going to have Yeti comparisons here. And I can't even say everything's bigger in Texas, but this is a excellent international guest that we're having on. And his reputation precedes him. Is that fair?
For sure.
I feel like everybody knows this guest. I get the pleasure of working with him on B31-8, where he is famously known for voting down his own proposed changes to B31-8, right? So every time that we joke like, oh, he's going to vote down his own change.
Well, the cool thing is, like, brand matters. And this gentleman has a brand, like the
definitely
full experience,
has a brand.
Right? It's like when you interact with this sage, you know exactly what you're going to get, right? There's the appearance. There's the wittiness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the experience.
Absolutely.
It's a whole brand.
So much fun. And you can also tell when people... maybe haven't met him because I usually mispronounce his last name.
Is very true.
I definitely remember the first time I tried to read his name and somebody was like, you're totally mispronouncing name. Which is great because if Miss Producer throws it up on the YouTube, I'm wondering if people will wonder whether or not I'm pronouncing it right. But without further ado, I think we can go ahead and introduce our guest. So our guest today is Mr. Keith Lavis. Yeah. And so if you want to bring him on, yes. Hey, welcome, Keith. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you very well. Thank you.
So I want to say thanks for joining us today. And it's not Keith Lewis. It is Keith Lavis for all of our listeners out there. And Keith, why don't you go ahead and, if you don't mind, give our listeners a little introduction. Tell us, who is Keith? What's your background? Why are you a sage?
And don't water it down. Why don't water it down. People need to know why you're a sage.
This is the time to flex.
If all the YPPers don't know who you are, this is when you get to
this is who you want for your mentor and show everybody.
So I could start with just the last 30 years, which goes back to risk assessment, right? Well, I won't go back 50.
Yeah, he's... That's your first flex. Bonus points. I'm only going to go back 30 years.
I've been working longer than most of you have been alive. Yeah,
so we're going to start on just two times longer than you've been in the industry. So that's where we'll cut this off.
So, yeah. So back in the early 90s is when I started to do risk assessment. Okay. And a number of us built the first one for what's now TC Energy. And at that point in time, I also sat on the PipeSafe committee and also Pyramid, which was the CFER one. The good part about PipeSafe is we got to blew a 36-inch pipeline up twice and take all kinds of readings and things because we needed to calibrate the thermal radiation. And it turned out...
I told you there because I actually saw that slide. I want the listeners to appreciate that is a true full scale test. Like it looked like a small mushroom cloud in the picture. So this was a full scale test of a 36-inch. How much gas, not air gas, natural gas. Like what was the scope of that test? If you don't mind that.
Well, one end of that line was plugged into Edmonton and the other end was plugged into Chicago. So.
That's awesome. So, just for some perspective.
Yeah, but we did have shut off valves 5 miles from each end, so we could terminate it pretty quickly. So, but yeah, that was a big test. Two of them, yeah.
But anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you, Keith, because I wanted to ask you about that on that slide you sent. So okay, so but going back, keep going. So 30 years ago, you started with Risk and TC Energy.
Early 90s,
and then I defected to the United States, and I started to work for GRI, and part of that was to begin to build the background for B-31-8S. So about 97, RESPA, which is now called FEMSA, and GTI and the pipeline industry started to have meetings about the things we needed to have to support B-31-8S. And if you look in the back in 14, you'll see a whole variety of GTI or GRI projects that we did to support B-31-8S to do the technology end of it. Right. And so that all came together. I think we wrote the first one in 2001. And that was the green covered one. And then 2002 was the first update. And then we had another update in 2004. By the time of 2004, I had added in all the DA stuff. One of the problems we had. We needed to find a home to put in direct assessment, and NACE wasn't quite ready yet, so we stuck it in the background S. And starting in 2004, we started to write the NACE standards. So by 2010, all the NACE standards were done, and about 2012, I think they started to show up in 192.
Hmm. So you have a rich background, needless to say, on the standards and the development side, with a focus on risk. That is really awesome to appreciate. You know, again, because you're describing a time period whenever I was actually in middle school.
I was still watching X-Men at home.
Well, wait, I was playing soccer. I mean, I was watching X-Men in middle school. Is that?
He said early 90s. I was in elementary. Oh,
okay. So anyway, but Keith, I do want to, again, thank you for joining us and give a little context to why specifically or how we ended up with you here and bring a little focus We did an episode on our Failure File series related to Sissonville and the advent of MCAs, really kind of the expansion of regulatory consequence areas from just high consequence to moderate. And some of the language in that report, the NTSB had noted specifically that the original intent of regulations was to protect against loss of life and that there was more that needed to be done beyond that. And in response to that episode, you sent me an email with a bunch of background. And I said this would make a fantastic episode, which is how we find ourselves here talking to you. So if you don't mind, I'd like you, I think most of our listeners are familiar with the concept of the PIR, but maybe not familiar with how and why it worked its way into code the way it did. Could you shed a little bit of light on that history there?
Yeah, so there is a variety of things. So we had, in B31A, we have the failure frequency part, and we have a consequence part. Okay, so part of it was to set out a basis for the consequence. So if we go back and look at line breaks we've had since 1970, for example, we can see the amount of trees they damaged. But we could also do a theoretical calculation. So the PIR has a number of assumptions in it. One is that every line break catches fire, which is not true. Second is the two outputs from the two ends interact with each other and get a single flame in the middle. And then we took that flame and we estimated mean point of that flame, and then we used calculations to get the thermal radiation as a function of distance from the rupture. So that made it a circle. But if you notice, many of these burn areas look more like dog bones. They don't interact, and they tend to miss each other and have two flames for a number of them. So sometimes the area is not really a circle. It's probably more like an oval. And if you take into account wind and other things, then that oval becomes spread over in a different area. But the first idea was, let's keep it simple. And we'll have a circle. And that circle has a dosage at the end of it of about 1%. Which was also equal to piloted ignition in about 20 or 16 minutes, I think, for wooden structures. So that meant you could hide in the wooden structure for the first 16 minutes and then bugger off, right?
So putting that in perspective, I want to make sure I recap. You developed a circle of which it had a 1% dosage, right? So 1% dosage means that only
1%. 1% lethality.
1% lethality. Okay, so 1% lethality and would catch a normal wooden structure on fire in about 16 minutes, give or take.
Well, in 16 minutes, it would have to be piloted ignition. So that meant something else had to be burning to set it on fire. Okay, so that's a wooden building because we wanted to have some shelter for people as well.
Right. But it doesn't guarantee. I mean, I think an important thing you're stating is that this doesn't guarantee you wouldn't have damage outside of the PIR. It definitely doesn't guarantee it if the fire burned for longer than 16 minutes. Most of the failures that we looked at have burned for longer than 16 minutes.
It takes more than the 16 minutes to determine to shut the valve off in some cases. Okay. Agreed. So, and yeah. So in many cases, we try to keep it to an hour to close the block valves and isolate the section. But that means you have to close all the linkages to the parallel lines as well. So your tie-ins, right? Because you keep the tie-ins open to keep the capacity up. So at San Bruno, for example, it was the tie-in to the line going by the airport that was shut last. Okay, and that turned the fire off. Yeah.
So one of the things I remember when we were discussing this episode, and again, I think it's useful because it is a, I think you said it, or maybe I said it, it's a very simplified way to do it. We take circles and we walk down the pipe, but we march down 660 feet and it's a fairly, let's say, crude way to do it. But one of the things that you mentioned was, you know, well, Rhett, at the time we were doing this, we were doing it with 486s. And I was like, what the heck is a 486, right? So,
it was a fast computer at the time.
Right. I think for most of our listeners, particularly our YPP, it's important to recognize that at the time, something so central to our regulatory, let's say, framework was brought into the picture was just simply due to resource limitations. We didn't have the computational horsepower that we did today. We don't have computers everywhere. So a very simple means for addressing the consequence of failure was developed in the form of a PIR. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so it was a screening tool. You'd have a circle and run it down the center of the pipeline. And you'd stop every so many distances and count the houses inside the circle. And if they exceeded 20, then you went to the upstream radius where it intersected the pipe. And that was the beginning of your HCA. And then you kept going until you ran out, the houses dropped below 20. And then you went to the downstream end, right? So you get an extra R on either end from the center points. And so that was a simple way of doing it. And you're right, we had only so much computing power. But if you notice, the HCA is a 192 invention. It's not a B-31-8 invention. So B-31-8, you're supposed to do from the start to the finish. And we couldn't do that at the time. So when we were talking with the regulators, then we decided on using it for 20 houses. And that ended up to be somewhere between 8% and 13% of most pipeline distances. And that meant they could do that. So, but part of the agreement that we had back in 2002, 2001 with the HCAs was that they would eventually get longer. So they invented MCAs, but that took about 10 years, right? And eventually they'll probably end up doing the entire pipeline length. Now, Inge at the time decided that they would try and have all of the houses covered by about 2024. Aha, it's this year. And have start to finish of the pipelines done by 2030.
When you say start to finish done, I'm sorry. What do you mean when you say start to finish done? Start to finish is covered by integrity programs, start to finish with a baseline, start to finish, what do you mean?
From pipeline milepost zero to whatever the end of it is, right? So 100% of your pipeline would be covered by 2030, according to what Inge would like to have, right? And in the beginning,
within an integrity management program.
Thank you. That's what I was getting covered by an integrity management program.
Because basically to tie this in.
No. Well, you're talking. S had an integrity management program for everything. The regulations had a limited one for the HCA, and that was to keep it manageable, right? And then, of course, the states really liked it if you just took class three and four and had an integrity management program for all of that and eliminated all the calculations except for class one and two. So that's how we got into the two different types of programs. And so now everything is integrity management for three and four, class three and four, and the screening circle for class one and two, right? And now the screening circle for class one and two has MCAs as well. Right. So this is where we're supposed to have people and we wanted to give them more protection.
So a couple of things to bring it around, Keith, if you can for us. And this is where I want your opinion. Yeah. So you said a couple of things that I want to kind of paint a picture from for you to speak to your thoughts. You said originally it was the goal was loss of life. right? So that's where we want to go. But we can't get there from the jump. And so we put this, as an industry, we put this plan in place, right? And it started with PIRs, and then PIRs drive or are part of how we're understanding consequence, right? It's part of risk management, right? So failure frequency and consequence. You address consequence by PIR. And then regs come in and say, well, we're only going to start IMPs on HCAs. And fast forward plus a decade, now we're bringing in MCAs. You having seen the original intent, you've seen the original intent, which was loss of life, and kind of what y'all stood up was based on the limitations of resources. We'll do that more broadly, right? Whether it's computers, processing, people, experience. We're now fast forwarding from 2000-ish, right? Initial regs, call it 02 to 04 timeframe. Now we're in 2023, going 2024 for this podcast. Speak to that as to where you think the adoption and this continuous improvement component is from an industry perspective.
Actually, you know what? I am going to give us a break on that question because I want to give Keith time. That's a big question, which is...
It was a two-part question.
It was a two-part question, and we're going to address both parts, Keith, right after we take a quick break. Hang on, and we'll be right back with Pipeline Things. All right, welcome back to Pipeline Things. Thanks for taking our break, where we have our guests, the esteemed Keith Lavis has been joining us as we talk about risk and where the pipeline industry was 30 years ago. So we left on a cliffhanger, and I wanted to do it intentionally because I thought it was a good place to take a break. But Chris, you asked a question.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to repeat that question again.
Sure.
Even though Mr. Lavis had plenty of time to think about it.
Yeah.
Give me more time to think about
it. No worries. So the question is, obviously you've been doing this for a long time, and there was a goal that was set at some point, right? Let's call it early 2000s when you guys were putting 8S together. Right. Let's fast forward. It's at least 20 years. And with the idea of it being the goal being, you know, preventing loss of life, you had an approach that was developed with the resources you had available at the time. But we all know that resources are incredibly evolved since and much more advanced, but we're still using a lot of the same tools. And we've seen even regulation lag in a similar fashion. You being the sage that you are with all the wealth of experience, and you knew what the goal was originally to where we are now, I would like for you to just share some very authentic, potentially passionate and opinionated thoughts on kind of where we are as an industry as a whole in being able to achieve that goal of loss of life.
Are we doing the right things, or should we be doing more?
Well, we're doing really good things for the likelihood of failure. So we're working really hard on that part. But I think the consequence of failure has not moved an awful lot in the last 20 years for many companies. Some companies are quite a bit farther ahead. So because we still use a screening tool and we just run it down the pipeline and it becomes HCA and now an MCA, and that just turns the switch on or off. And whether you're doing more integrity inspections, right? Looking at things, inspecting things. But, you know, one of the real advantages with failure frequency is if you can granulate it, then you can zero in on where you need to spend the money. If we granulate the consequences as well, then we could narrow down where we need to spend the money as well. So right now, it's almost like a off and on switch. You either have a whole bunch of houses or you don't, right? And with HCA or MCAs, it's you have not quite as many houses, but a bunch of houses. And so on either side of an HCA or in some of the smaller areas where you go through, you'll find an MCA. So if we take the circle, right, and... So we know that the circle is an ideal round thing. We could add things to it like the likelihood of failure, because the bigger the diameter, the more chances it will ignite, right? And then we could add things to that like what happens to the prevailing wind? Does the circle change? The other thing we could do is we could make it into a target symbol. You know, do you guys shop at Target, right? For all kinds of stuff. So it's like the big red bullseye, right?
Yes. My wife does as well.
Substantially. Like, I categorize our purchases every month, Keith, like line by line. And the number of Target purchases is astounding. And I'm thankful now that my wife does not listen to the podcast, so she will not hear me call that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it doesn't help that there's a Starbucks in it. That's a great example, is that Target symbol. So the outside of the circle is the 1% lethality. Then you could use 25, 50% lethality, right? And when you run the smaller circles down, you capture different houses. Those houses would have a higher likelihood of consequence. So you can start to get some granularity that way. Right.
Well, let me make an argument. Keith, what if an operator just said, all you're going to do is expand my integrity program now?
No, you're going to separate your integrity program into more granularity. And you're only interested on the high risk ones, right?
So what are your thoughts, Keith, on why we haven't moved that needle?
Yeah, why?
Right?
Why?
So if we look at, for example, the Pipeline Safety Acts, we've seen that there is congressional mandates towards using more data-driven techniques like ILI. Why is it that we're not seeing more on the consequence side, meaning whether it's data integration or anything that doesn't mean you will dig this case? Because that's normally what we see right now. That's how they're managing consequence.
Yeah, there are two things. One is internally driven by the operator, and the second one is regulatory driven, but the regulatory driven depends on who's holding the house, right? And since 2002, we've had Republicans and Democrats switching back and forth a bunch, right? So the MCA, I think, was proposed back in the old times, back probably 06 or something like that. But by the time it worked its way through, different administrations have different emphasis on what they want done. It didn't pop out till what, 2019, something like that. So that's one of the problems. The other one is the same question that Rhett asked about, aren't you just going to make things that I have to do more integrity? But you're still working with inside the HCA. So, but now you're just adding a number of onto your consequences. So you're going to sort them out into different groups with lower risk and higher risk. Don't forget, HCAs are only doing 13% of the pipeline, right? Plus whatever is in your class 3 and 4, which is probably less than 3% anyway for most big pipelines. So the most of the regular pipeline just gets the normal kinds of stuff, which is corrosion and leaks, right?
So one of the things I remember Jerry telling me, and I want to maybe shift focus, maybe not shift focus, but maybe I want to hear your thoughts on this, right? So Jerry Rao, he brought me into the pipeline integrity world. He always had this idea of, Chris, what you have to appreciate is it's what should happen. This was his perspective, is it's industry should come together and develop a recommended practice or standard. And then that's what we as an industry believe in, and that's how we should operate. And regulation should follow in one way or another. Right. So my question to you is, it's obviously you've been on a lot of standards committees. You've seen a lot of regulatory changes. Is it, as an industry, do you think that we have the right frameworks in place so that we continue to make the right decisions? Because, again, we see a lot of actions and dollars being put towards assessments, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the assessments are driving down risk. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So that's two. One is you need the volunteers on the standards in order to make sure that we're working at the front end of the technology, right? And that's been harder and harder. And Rhett probably has his own opinions about how we get people onto B31.8 and other standards. And the other one is to have the various companies, the operators, have the passion to try and sharpen the pencil to spend their money at the right spot and not over a great big area. So some companies are really doing that. So I also sit on CSA, Z662. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be some new stuff coming out for risk assessment on that part. And so they're getting into more sophisticated analysis through the consequence end, which if we're waiting for the regulatory people to drive it, it's taking time. So in about 17 to 19, we had a risk assessment group that was put together by FEMSA, and I was on there as the B31-8 rep for that. And so there are recommendations that came out of that, and some of that will come through the regulatory. Since I've been involved in working with regulatory through INGA back probably before 2000 in this century, it's a we've always tried to get ahead of things, so we tried to do that with Q, but the regulatory people decided they wanted to write their own. And so there are a whole variety of different things. And when you think about the regulatory for 192, a lot of their Part O has come from B31-8S, but they just, maybe this is a bad word, cherry-picked it for the best parts, right?
So yeah, 192 only incorporates the 2004 version that you talked about, right? That has the DA site in it, but it hasn't incorporated any of the more modern ones.
Yeah,
so, which was a topic on the GPAC when they were coming out with the latest regulation, but we didn't see that change yet.
Well, they've been talking 2018 lately, but my personal opinion is 2004 was the last version we had both ECDA and ICDA in, right? And so they may have wanted to keep that, but both of those are now in 192. It took like 15 years to get them in there, but they're there now, right? So and they
yeah, I see.
They didn't actually do confirmatory direct assessment, which I think is can't do anything, but anyway, I helped write that one too, so I helped write all of the standards.
Some challenges, you know, as we talk about trying to implement something that would be more granular in terms of consequence. And the reality is there's two sides, right? There's limited resources. I'm going to say more in terms of people and maybe in terms of competency on the operator side after you get past the big operators. And then I also think that from a regulatory perspective, I think, Keith, the regulators like the on-off switch. It tells them where they need to look and where they don't need to look. I think
that's when you good talk for about audits.
Prescriptive regulation. What's that?
It's good for audits.
It is good for audits, right? When you talk in terms of prescriptive regulation, I could see why it would be a challenge for regulators to do it. Not saying we shouldn't. Again, regulations set the minimum bar. So I think operators should be encouraged to look beyond the minimum bar. But from a regulatory and an audit perspective, they're going to favor an on-off switch, not a targeted approach that has maybe a scaling zone that goes down. That's a whole separate conversation. You know, again, I've been struggling with that whole prescriptive versus non-prescriptive approach.
We're not into performance-based yet, and we may never get there. We're always into
prescriptive.
Right. So we have the 9 prescriptive threats, right? And we know there's a lot more than those, and the granularity helps you out as well. So so there's a variety of things that we could talk about. Can I make a plug? Because you talked about software. So if you wanted software for consequences, then there are two companies I've kind of worked with. So I used to work for Advantica at one time. It's now DNV. They can do consequences much better. And I worked for Dynamic Risk as well. And they write software for these kinds of things too. So there's help out there if you wanted to get more granularity and you don't necessarily have the staff to do it yourself. All right.
So I want to let our audience know you glitched there for a moment and the internet got grain. That was not intentional. He plugged both. It was Advantica.
Advantica DNV
and Dynamic Risk.
DNV bought Advantica, right?
Yeah. Keith, I actually, as we move towards the close of the podcast, I want to ask you what your thoughts are. Like PIR, it's been a great conversation as it pertains to natural gas. Yeah. But we know a lot of the conversation in the industry is not around natural gas anymore. It's around CO2 and hydrogen. And what are your thoughts on this PIR-based, non-granular? Like, if we're trying to take the current methods we have and apply them to CO2 and hydrogen, what problems? What does this create? What do you think?
Well, for hydrogen, you can use the PIR. Recent work indicates that the thermal radiation from a hydrogen is about the same as methane. And if you go back to the earlier TNO reports, it sounded like it was about half or 60%. But it turns out with recent work that it's not that, it's higher. So it'll be about the same. So you could use the PIR screening tool for hydrogen. For CO2, it doesn't combust, and it is heavier than air. The other two are both lighter than air, so it goes straight up, right? Plus, if they're burning, then you get thermal heat, which drags it up as well. The other one sits on the ground and runs downhill. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be round. It's going to depend on the terrain that you're in. So you need a whole different set of calculations to estimate what it'll look like. So about 4% can get kind of toxic. And so that means that it's hard to drive. And it's hard to do those kinds of things. And when it starts getting up to 5%, then the engine in your car won't work. And it's even harder for yourself. And if you sit in a valley, then it may be like propane. So it would be in a spot where the air gets pushed out of that. So your consequences will change. Again, the two I plugged are people to begin talking with. However, if you look at the EPA, you already have free software out there that you can grab. But again, you've got to have people that know how to use it or want to learn how to use it, right? So there's lots of free stuff to help. So the first thing is you've got to figure out how much is coming out, at what rate, over what time. So with thermal radiation, for example, if we close the valves and then we have a line break and we have 5 minutes to get out of the building, the chances are there's not a lot of help we can give for personal damage, because it can take 25 minutes to an hour to get down for the thermal radiation to get down to where the fire people can just begin to cross the PIR. So they can't even go in and do search and rescue. And so that was one of the things I was trying to get across at the PPIM as well. And that work was done 10 years ago and presented to FEMSA as well. So in many cases with thermal radiation, you can reduce the amount of property damage possibly. Rescuing people is very difficult if they haven't found shelter. And with CO2, you can asphyxiate people really quickly if you haven't planned it out. And that's why it's really important to do your homework ahead of time and then talk to your internal emergency response and also the fire and police, because they're going to be in control. We haven't been in control for over 20 years. So we just provide advice.
Yeah. So Keith, I want to ask you this question. Maybe looking a little bit to the future. Brett and I, we have a lot of focus on trying to do knowledge share and knowledge transfer, right? I mean, it's how I learned a lot, how I continue to try to learn is talking to the sages of the industry and leverage experience. As we look at maybe some of the younger generation, I remember when I got hired, you've said this a couple times on the podcast, the rooms are always filled with gray-haired people. And it was just a few of us. And then fortunately, over the last 5 years or so, we've put this big emphasis on hiring younger talent, YPP type organizations, bringing them in. Assuming we have some younger generation or some younger people who are in pipelines trying to do a good job, what's the message you would give to them directly, right? Taking at least 30 years of your experience, right? And seeing how standards developments happen, how codes implemented, how operators are making decisions. What words do you give some of that the younger generation that may be listening to this message?
Moments with the Sage, brought to you by Pipeline Things.
Yes. So the best thing is what you've been talking about all along, is do the monitoring and get ahead of problems, right? So that we don't end up with ruptures. If we want to talk about ruptures, and this is that, because now you've got a big problem, right? Then you probably need to invest some more time in figuring out the consequences and how you can stay ahead of that, right? But the whole idea
integrity management is the best way to prevent failures.
Keep the product inside the pipeline, right? If you can do that. Because we didn't, 30 years ago, we really didn't have the same kind of ILI we have now. We also have magnetometers and things that you can take over the line. You can find stress peaks, things of this nature as well. Mm-hmm. Plus, our CP is so much better these days, right, for corrosion. And corrosion has been a major problem ever since the day one. So the best idea to prevent problem is stay ahead of your maintenance. And leak detection now. So we have two types of leak detection. We have the BRE-31-8, which is if it bubbles, you're in troubles. And now we have, that was bad, eh? And we have EPA, which is down to parts per million now, kind of thing, right? So in most cases, we're interested in finding spots where the wall is thin enough that the product is getting out, right? Yeah. And now we can do it with aircraft and stuff with spectral, looking at different wavelengths of light in order to pick up different kinds of oils and gases and things of that nature as well.
If you had an opportunity to listen to this podcast, and if you have not met Mr. Keith Lavis, next time you see him, go shake his hand and start a conversation. He might not appreciate that, but do yourself a favor. Go meet Keith Lavis, shake his hand.
Thanks.
Well, fantastic. I think that's a great wrap up to the show. I want to say thanks for joining us, Keith, and for all of the, a rich history, and you've given a lot to the pipeline industry. So
yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us and thanks for sharing us. I don't think this will be the last time we'll talk to you, because I think we'll pick up this conversation in different forms.
Yeah. Have you noticed that some of the sages of the industry, they come on the podcast one or another uninvited, and then we invite them?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a trend going on here.
And now he's fought his way on. I mean, we'll have to just keep having him
keeping
on.
Him so on.
There are other regulations I'm sure we need to talk about.
Well, I'm always happy, especially to talk to young pipeliners, right? Because that's how information gets exchanged. And the PPIM is a really good one. IPC is another good one coming up as well in September this year. Though we don't get that many people coming up from down south. Mm-hmm. So there are other opportunities as well.
Absolutely. But
yeah, just buttonhole me, and I'm always willing to talk, right? I have opinions.
All right. You have opinions.
Yes, and
anybody
somebody will have to sort
the
through them, right?
Well, fantastic. Well, I just want to say thank you. And, I think that's going to wrap it up. So thank you all for joining us on this episode of Pipeline Things. I'm your host, Rhett Dotson, and we will be back in 2 weeks with a different sage. Looking forward to it. Thanks. See you again in the future.
Be safe. Take care.